I'll begin by reading one of my favorites on nature from George MacDonald. If the flowers were not perishable, we should cease to contemplate their beauty, either blinded by the passion for hoarding the bodies of them, or dulled by their commonplaceness that the constant presence of them would occasion. To compare great things with small, the flowers wither, the bubbles break, the clouds and sunsets pass, for the very same holy reason for which the Lord withdrew from his disciples and ascended again to his Father, that the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, the soul of things, might come to them and abide with them, and so the Son return and the Father be revealed. The flower is not its loveliness, and its loveliness we must love, else we shall only treat them as flower-greedy children who gather and gather and fill hands and baskets from a mere desire of acquisition. No creature has fouled his nest as extensively as man. And today my subject will be our contaminated environment. When I think of our contaminated environment, I think of that little phrase, we have engaged the enemy and it is us. John, Tom, and Jim were heading for the railroad station, and they thought they were late for the train. They weren't. The train was late, as also is often the custom. On such an occasion, of course, the three of them hit the cocktail lounge for two, which got to be three double martinis. And suddenly, they realized the train had already arrived in the station without them hearing it. So they ran for the train. Tom and Jim were faster, and they caught the train as it was just pulling out of the station. John missed it. The station master saw that he was very concerned, so he came over to him, put his arm around him, and he says, "Sorry, you missed the train." He hoped he didn't feel too bad. He says, "Me? How about my friend Tom and Jim? They came down to see me off." Tom and Jim were on a train that they didn't want to be on. And Tom and Jim are like many of us that are on a train that they'd probably rather not be on. And this mythical train that I speak of is following an unknown course whose principal engineers are science and technology. And science and technology, which is presently being supported to the tune of an excess of $20 billion a year. And it's changing the world so rapidly that we are having difficulty accommodating. I think we saw some of this last night. We are continually facing what Irving Bengelsdorf, who is one of the better science correspondents in this country, he writes for the Los Angeles Times, former GE engineer, chemical engineer. We are continually facing this culture shock. Before we can adjust to one change, a new one develops. And we are assaulted by then countless more new ideas, concepts, techniques, which challenge, in many cases, our cherished traditions. Not even the most brilliant of our scientists knows where this so-called mythical train is taking them. But this we know. The train is really gathering speed. There are many unknown switches. No single scientist, unfortunately, or fortunately probably, is in the engine cab. And there are probably demons at some of the switches. Most of society, including many scientists, are in the caboose. They're looking backward to where we've been and variously viewing with alarm, pride, and shame. And that's where many of us are. And in part, this is where I'm going to be part of today. Fortunately, some of those in the back of the train are trying to communicate with those up front. And we hope that we can do some of that here today. I don't mean to intimate that I'm quite a ways up front, although I've been involved in some work and some decisions and proposals. that at times have removed me from the caboose. And I'm sure there are others here who are probably in a similar situation, or who at some later time will find themselves up near the cab, if not in the cab. Now, as we proceed through this morning, I hope that you'll feel free to interrupt at any time and either challenge me or bring up a point that I'm probably missing. Often at this time of the year, around 4th of July, probably one time of the year which we sing America the Beautiful, and it's a song I have enjoyed very much, probably because I was born and raised in the most beautiful part of the country, which is the Pacific Northwest, even though I do not now live here. And I've written a kind of a lousy parody on this, which goes something like this. Oh, how detestful for smog-filled skies, for contaminated waves of grain, for scavenged mountains lying scarified above the smoke-filled plain. Oh, shame on you for what you do, you haven't seen beyond the years, for every day thy cities spew smog-producing human tears. And that sort of sums up the lecture. And with this parody, I introduce probably one of the most perplexing problems that plague our developing technology today, the deteriorating quality of our environment. We have been really fouling our nest since Leif Erikson did discover America some 1,000 years ago. And initially, this unspoiled land was easily capable of absorbing all our wastes, and this is long since true. It has already cost us dearly, and it will cost us a great deal more with the predicted population growth just in the next couple of decades. Now, I ran out and obtained a copy of something that I put in the library last year, and it's called the Restoring the Quality of Our Environment. Some of us in the business refer to this as the Tukey Report. It's a report of the Environmental Pollution Panel of the President's Scientific Advisory Committee. And if Johnson didn't write it, chances are he didn't, but he did sign the sort of foreword in this. And in this he said, pollution now is one of the most pervasive problems of our society. With our numbers increasing and with our increasing urbanization and industrialization, the flow of pollutants to our air, soils, and waters is increasing. This increase is so rapid that our present efforts in managing pollution are barely enough to stay even, surely not enough to make the improvements that are needed. And I think he's giving us too much credit for what we're able to do now. I think this will become evident as we go through here. And some of you who are interested in this, feel free to go into the library and obtain it. Now, we're going to look at contamination sort of air, water, and soil. The first one is air. Now, in one periodical that many people read, they recalled for us a few events that have happened in the area of air pollution. In 4 days in 1948, polluted air sickened 43% of the population of Donora, Pennsylvania. And that's pretty good going. And they killed 20. In 4 days in 1952, it killed 4,000 people in London. In 15 days in 1963, it killed 400 people in New York City. Some of you may recall that. Polluted air undoubtedly kills many people in many other places, but they're not counted because the death certificates never read air pollution. And few cities ever analyze how many extra deaths they get during a siege of severe air pollution. Now, this air pollution comes from a burning of fuels, of course, coal, oil, and natural gas, homes, vehicles, and factories. And of course, in some areas, now they're cutting down the burning of refuse in certain areas because of this. And this produces not only tremendous amounts of sort of colloid or suspended particles in the air, but also gases In fact, probably the worst part of it is are some of the gases that are produced. But the suspended colloid, and I just had this call to my attention. I'm not sure. I haven't been able to verify it, but in a conversation with René Debeau, or Debeau's, he pronounces it either way. He doesn't care now because he sort of made it. He was at Rockefeller for many years, and I guess he still works out at Rockefeller. He received the big national award from the Science Center, you know, in Seattle. But it's a national award, sort of. It's a bit like the American Nobel Prize award for the person who has contributed to science and been able to communicate it to people like you and me. And it's worth $25,000. And in discussion with him when he visited our laboratory recently, he told me that something that he said a lot of people don't realize, and that is the greatest contribution to sort of suspended colloid particles and this kind of material in the atmosphere is not the burning of hydrocarbons so much, but material from where the rubber hits the road, sort of. I mean, the worn tire material that's suspended, and brake lining. Now, I haven't read this anywhere else, and of course, this is of some concern, and the reason that I act sort of surprised about it, and one of the reasons maybe I never thought about it, but when you get, of course, millions and millions of cars, you're going to have a lot of brake linings, and I think they still make these out of asbestos. And if you can breathe enough of that, you get what we call asbestosis, which is something you'd rather not have. Now, this gas not only, of course, affects people, it injures and kills trees, crops, flowers, as you know from Donora, Pennsylvania, and other incidents, it irritates eyes, noses, and throats. It aggravates certain lung conditions. Of course, it's a real stress on some cardiac patients. And there are many people who believe that it contributes to lung cancer, increases the incidence, along with cigarette smoking and other assaults on the air passages. Now, of course, automobiles are a great source of this, and we're right now spawning more cars than babies, essentially double, I think. I think we're producing more than 8 million cars a year. And we aren't producing quite that many babies, I don't think. Fuel burning contributes about 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide to our air each year. And by the year 2000, we'll have about 25% more CO2 in the air. And as we discussed, I think during the, or maybe I brought it up during your lecture, Larry, that I don't know whether I said it right then or not, but I think I mentioned when on my nuclear energy lecture, when you discharge a lot of particulate material in the air, and this is one of the concerns in nuclear war, in extensive nuclear war, is that you get a lot of particles suspended, which will cut off the light rays, and then you'll have, you'll change the weather in this country to the extent that you'll have snow here all year round, and we'll have weather in Northern California more like sort of Juneau, Alaska, or something like this. This is the thing we're concerned about there. Well, the opposite is true here, because carbon dioxide, see now, it absorbs the infrared, so then it acts like a greenhouse, you see, and it'll increase the temperature. And we are, I think, on an increasing temperature right now. I mean, our environmental temperature is increasing. And it is, with a 25% increase in carbon dioxide, it's predicted that the increase in temperature will be up to about 7 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, if half of the fossil fuels were burned, and I don't know what the prediction it is, but it isn't too long in the future, we'll get about 3 times this effect. And of course, the concern here is that when you increase the temperature this much, you will then have a melting of the snow, the ice pack up north and the polar cap, And this will, of course, increase the water level. In fact, it's predicted it may go up as high as 100 feet. But a lot of the people who are concerned about this say, well, it's one thing that'll do, and it'll pretty much submerge the main sources of our contamination of the air. It'll certainly take care of much of L.A. As I recall, Davis, California is about 18 feet above sea level. So I'll have to buy a boat, I guess. I've been putting it off all these years. That's about all I'm going to say about air right now in nuclear energy, except to say this. In the nuclear energy program, we have probably done as much, if not more, than a lot of people in evaluating the hazards of inhaled radioactive particulates. For those of you who are from the Southwest, an associate of mine now has a laboratory where he's going to end up with more dogs than we have, probably in excess, quite a bit in excess of 1,000 beagles, on experiment checking the effects of inhaled radioactive particulates at low level, and to study the long-term effects of these, and also particulate removal. My associates at Hanford Laboratories have had work going on for many, many years. In fact, we started in about 1950. This is a very difficult problem, I should say, studying the effects of inhaled particulates, just to determine the dose of exposure, for example. And the mechanics of it and all are really very difficult, but great advances have been made in this. It turns out, however, that although the dog is a very good experimental animal for this, there is a better one, and that's the burro or the horse. And I have suggested that they get some miniature horses and utilize them. But the horse lung is very similar, and we have work going on at the University of California, Davis, for example, studying emphysema, because it's a very good model for man, studying emphysema. Now, on water contamination, we don't have to go back very many years. In fact, about two in New England states, you know, they were really rationing their water. They were really in tough straits there about 2 years ago. I remember flying over Texas within the last 10 years, I guess, and boy, it really looked terrible. Water shortages are a common thing now. And going back to that New England incident, New York City was parceling out their water very carefully, yet the Hudson River was flowing by at about 30,000 gallons per second, but it was too filthy to be utilized. And the American Great Lakes, which represents about a quarter of the world's supply of fresh water, there's a decreasing water level, as I understand it, and there's, of course, great increases in pollution. Lake Erie has probably been the one that's hardest hit because it's a dumping ground for industrial waste and sewage. I can give you the values on this if you want them, from four states and from a province of Canada. And to show you the sad state of affairs, just look at the number of the blue pike that were caught there 30 years ago. At that time, about 20 million pounds of blue pike were taken by the commercial fishermen. And in about 1964, they caught less than 1,000 pounds. It's essentially sort of a dead sea, except for the algae growing, because they release a lot of material into it that might promote the growing of algae. And we see this also happening. I mean, San Francisco Bay is getting polluted. Lake Washington is polluted. Puget Sound will increase in the level of pollution. Lake Tahoe, which is a lovely spot in California, between California and Nevada. Already you could fly over and see the green algae taking over where people are dumping sewage into it. What happens, you see, is that with increased materials into the lake, there's a reduction in the available oxygen. And of course, no oxygen, no fish, and it gets to be a real mess. Or as we say, the sewage disposal is a real mess. And the cost of cleaning up waters, I mean, if we just set on a program right now to clean up our water resources, it would probably cost in the neighborhood of about $75 billion, it's estimated, over the next decade, the next, this generation, sort of about 30 years. And this is sort of a rough estimate. Now, the water shortage, there is some exciting advances in the area of providing water from nuclear energy, that is desalting seawater. Soon there will be built in the environs of Los Angeles a very large reactor that will not only produce power for that area in very substantial amounts, but will also produce fresh water, probably supplying about 15% of the water supply from the sea for the greater Los Angeles area. And as the technology is developed, they're planning several of these, for example, in India, as I mentioned to you the other day. And of course, they also hope to utilize, and I might say that one of the problems in really utilizing seawater for and converting it to fresh water is that what do you do with all the stuff that you take out of the salt? I mean, the salt and all these other things. Well, some of it, of course, is utilizable. Some of it may be utilized for fertilizer, for example, and this is what Weinberg, from who's director of Oak Ridge National Lab, says they are looking forward to with great anticipation. His laboratory is doing a lot of the work on this, and he is really quite optimistic about this. I discussed this with him at a meeting in San Juan just within the last 2 months. Now, another big problem has to do with solid waste. And I don't know if you, I'm sure you must have thought about it, because even you can't even go around camp here without seeing just a lot of trash. Or I think the kids picked up just around this building, you know, and found a fantastic amount of stuff. I don't mean just broken branches and stuff that would naturally accumulate there, but stuff that were placed there by man, bottles and all this type of stuff. The land pollution really staggers the imagination. For each person in the United States has to get rid of about 4.5 pounds of solid waste each day. Now, this is almost a ton for each of you per day, and for me too, about 1,600 or 1,700 pounds, maybe more than that for some people. Now, this costs us about $2 billion a year to get rid of. There are, just to give you a few of these things, I don't know if you've thought about it much, 48 billion metal cans, 26 billion bottles and jars, 65 billion metal and plastic bottle caps, and miscellaneous packages and containers. Now, the sad state of affairs here is that paper cartons, of course, that we used to use a lot of, and less now, do deteriorate. And tin cans for a while rust. If you get a real feeling for this, although it takes them quite a while, if you just walk up Honeymoon Heights and come up to the old garbage dump for the village here. It's kind of interesting to look at garbage dumps. A lot of people sort of looked at me askance the other night when I came trucking back on a few things. I told them I'd been to the garbage dump for the old village, you know. They looked at me about the same way as when I tell them I watch birds. But you can get a pretty good feel for a population or a village if you look at their garbage dump. It gives you a new insight into them. But the point that I want to make here is that we haven't been satisfied to just utilize paper cartons and tin cans. We've gone to aluminum, which lasts much longer. It doesn't rust, you know. And plastics are well nigh eternal. I mean, they just last and last and last, and we've gone more and more to this. So we're just accumulating. And I think our situation is not too different from many others. In Davis, California, we're in one of the richest agricultural regions, probably in all the world, in the northern end of it. And of course, we still utilize, I mean, and it makes me ill, and I was going to bring this up yesterday, but I mean, we're fast getting to the point where we really can't afford to take any more of our best agricultural land and convert it to dwellings. We just, I don't believe, can afford it. And it's a frightening thing to see it being done to me. I mean, when we got a bunch of land that isn't good for anything else in a way, that we could build nice houses on with a better view usually, because it's usually higher. And when we melt the polar ice cap, you'll be at a higher elevation. Now,
in our situation in Davis, California, I mean, where do we dump all this stuff? Well, you go out and build a great big trench out there in this very valuable land. You burn some of it, and it makes a nice smog cover over the city. And then you bury it, and then take over a new area. Well, that area that you've just covered up has, of course, then limited use. And then when you finish that, then you go and dig up another section. And this is very valuable land. In fact, just in the outskirts, $16,000 to $20,000 an acre. And some of it, you see, that's what you can get for it. Well, this is an expensive garbage pit. So what do you do about that? Well, our chancellor said that we have here an undramatic problem that needs a very dramatic approach in a dramatic short period of time. And I think that's probably well stated. Now, of course, some of this material can be reutilized by the National Association of Secondary Material Industries, which you know as junkies. And some of it is utilized by them, but it has to be rewarding financially. Now, I mentioned just briefly radioactive contamination. I talked about it the other day. We're going to get at some of the things we might do about this, or the causes of some of this, and I'm going to mention in industry, and then Paul's going to tell us about that. I will just say this on radioactive contamination, that in my own mind, and in the minds of many other people who have taken probably a more objective look than I have on it, that in the area of industrial contamination, nuclear industry has probably a far better posture than any other. We have defined our contaminants, our potential hazards, better than essentially any other industrial waste. Of course, this has not been without a great deal of expense, and we've had a lot of experience now in research and defining these hazards. We haven't defined them all, but we are in a very good position, and I think our history on this is very good, yet it's probably one of the most hazardous. I mean, we're dealing with one of the most hazardous products and producing them, yet we've done this with fantastically low loss of life. Now, in California, up till now, there have been no power reactors built from nuclear energy. And for a while, the coal industry kept really beating the drum, saying, boy, you don't want this radioactive stuff all over California. You know, because, boy, you'll really be in trouble. Your children will be monsters and all this kind of stuff. And they really stirred it up. Part of it was due to the real estate lobby, because I think they made some unwise choices as to where they were going to put the reactors. But the coal lobby did, of course, put in a good deal of money in there. But they've been quiet lately because a friend of mine named Eisenbud, who's in charge of an industrial medicine lab associated with New York University, I think, made some calculations and evaluations and determined that for an equivalent power production, the burning of coal produces a great deal more radioactive material than what is released from a power reactor. Because they forgot to figure that in coal, of course, there's a lot of other materials, including radium. And if you're going to breathe things, radium isn't one of those things you'd like to breathe, even in low amounts. And there are other radioactive materials in it. So the coal, we haven't really heard much from the coal lobby lately. And the other thing is that, of course, they put a lot of dirt in the air too, which a nuclear reactor does not do. There are very stringent rules that apply to the siting of reactors, and of course the industry is very disturbed about this. And I still have a minor affiliation with General Electric Company in their atomic power division, and this does concern them from the standpoint of economy, where they feel that they don't have to be this careful, that they don't have to have this great big pressurized dome over their reactor. And to give you an illustration of this, when they built their shipping port reactor in Pennsylvania, I'm not too sure if that wasn't a second-rate engineering firm that did that, Westinghouse by name, I think. But there were certain rules applied to the effluent of this plant from the local authorities, and of course the AEC has certain requirements on this. In other words, the effluent from from the laboratory in which I work or from any other, you essentially have to, the water cannot exceed sort of drinking level values of radioactive contamination, you see. Well, they established certain rules for the effluent from the shipping port reactor, and they exceeded